Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility present The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, committed to a healthy and clean environment, strong communities, and craft beer. AlchemistBeer.com. By Community Capital of Vermont, providing equal access to financing for Vermonters with excellent ideas and the courage and resourcefulness to start and grow small businesses. Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers to create a home, business, and community-based energy system that's clean, reliable, and cost-effective. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable child care in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. And by UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine, as well as nearly 700 BBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more from www.vbsr.org.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. In the 1940s and 50s, a Red Scare swept the country, and it blew right into Vermont. Author Rick Winston has been an avid historian of the little-known McCarthy-era anti-communist witch hunt here in Vermont. He has a new book, Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy Era, 1946 to 1960. Rick, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Great to be here, David.
You were on 4 years ago talking about the very beginnings of your research for this book, so I'm really delighted to see the fruition of your efforts.
Yes, when I came on this show, I had just had one chapter of it published in Vermont History Magazine and was doing a talk somewhere around here.
And I was so intrigued by even the notion of a Red Scare in the Green Mountains that I couldn't resist having you at least give us the beginning of your research. Let's start with a little of the phraseology of the era. Your book is called Red Scare in the Green Mountains. Was there a difference between the Red Scare and McCarthyism?
I like to differentiate between the two terms. They're used interchangeably, but I prefer Red Scare because it conveys first the emotional content of the era. And the other reason I prefer it is that it didn't start with McCarthy and it didn't end with McCarthy. Looking back on it, his meteoric rise and fall only lasted 4 years. So even though his dates where he dominated the news cycle were 1950 to 1954, I found two episodes really worth exploring. One from 1946 and one from 1948, before he even took the national stage.
Did McCarthyism have a different flavor and a different target than the Red Scare?
No. It took the already existing Red Scare to new heights, is the way I put it. In one way of looking at it, there's been a Red Scare as long as there have been Reds, like since the Russian Revolution. Because sometimes I talk to some historians and they say, well, are you talking about the first Red Scare or the second one? And the answer is, I'm talking about the second one because the first one was directly after World War One, when people like Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman were deported and the Attorney General Mitchell Palmer led raids on the various socialist, anarchist, left-leaning groups.
What led you to want to write this book?
Well, it goes back to my parents, who were both New York City school teachers, and they were both quite caught up in this era. My father actually lost his job because of his former political affiliations. My mother, through an accident of timing, just wound up keeping hers till she retired. But I didn't hear these stories until like 10 years later when I was a teenager. And as I kind of came into adulthood, and which was in the 60s, and we had our own political things to be involved in, I looked at their experiences in a new light that it explained a lot about decisions that the family had taken, and that this era was very much kind of the background of my growing up without my actually knowing it. So I got to Vermont in 1970, just when things were changing a bit. Bernie Sanders had his first run for governor, and we were coming off the Phil Hoff era. So I started just wondering idly what happened here during that time, because you figure it was a national phenomenon. It had to have manifestations in no matter what state of the union you happen to live in.
When you say that your family, the Red Scare affected decisions and choices that your family made, what do you mean?
Well, my father, one of his former pupils, grew up to be a paid informer, first for the FBI and then for Senator McCarthy himself. So my father was named in front of a U.S. Senate investigative committee about communist influence in the New York City public school system. So my father knew that he was going to get fired sooner or later. So he actually resigned to go into private business. This was happened when I was 5 or 6. So,
and the student who kind of ratted out your father, was he being paid while he was a student?
No, because he was a very committed left activist as a student, but for various reasons got disillusioned and went over to the other side. After a few years of being a paid informant, he recanted and wrote a book about his experience called False Witness. His name, by the way, is Harvey Matuzzo. And he wound up ending the careers of many people, not only in education, but in show business and in various social services, labor movement.
Did your father or you ever meet this fellow after he ended your father's teaching career?
Nope. Although I have friends in Central Vermont that, oh, I know that guy. He was friends of my good friend. You know, he spent time in Vermont and New Hampshire as the years went on. He actually died in New Hampshire.
Huh. Well, take us back to the beginning of, and just explain what led to the rise of McCarthyism. How did these two, the Red Scare and McCarthyism, dovetail, and how did this senator from Wisconsin come to be who we know him to be?
I'll try to make this brief, because this is a big topic.
Well, let me just remind listeners, you're listening to the Vermont Conversation. My guest this week for the hour is Rick Winston, who has a new book, Red Scare in the Green Mountains. If you want to join this conversation, if you know someone on either side of the Red Scare, of the anti-communist witch hunts, tell us a story. We're at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Okay, so Rick, I just teed you up to tell us about how McCarthyism came to be.
Yes, well, go back to the Depression when a lot of people actually joined the Communist Party feeling that this was a viable option, that it became, in certain people's views, obvious that the capitalist system was failing. The civil war in Spain had broken out, and it was clear that the United States government wasn't doing anything, but that Russia was helping the loyalist side in the Spanish Civil War. There was always a strong anti-New Deal sentiment among certain people, and especially certain people in the Republican Party, who felt that the New Deal itself was socialistic and communistic, and a lot of those qualms were put aside with the outbreak of World War II, when the United States and the Soviet Union became allies. And with the end of World War II and Roosevelt's untimely death, Harry Truman came to power, and his advisors were not Roosevelt's advisors, who wanted him to, not cozy up with Joe Stalin. So that quickly that alliance fell apart, with the Soviets taking power in various Eastern European countries, and like in Czechoslovakia in 1948. So there was, at the same time, the labor movement was at its height of its power by the end of World War II, and there's tremendous pushback. Talk about history repeating itself. 1946 elections returned a Republican Senate and a Republican Congress for the first time since the New Deal started. So there was a lot of pressure on Harry Truman that he wasn't tough enough on communism. It's easy to forget that 3 years before McCarthy, it was Truman who instituted what he called the loyalty program at the State Department, where people had to sign loyalty oaths and were being investigated for their political affiliations. So there's a lot of pushback against the organized labor movement, and again, many on the Republican side were using the specter of communism as a cudgel to beat the labor movement. It was a time of great uncertainty. People were getting very anxious about perceived threats from without and from within. And by the time McCarthy arrived on the scene, it was a movement in waiting for a demagogue to jump on that bandwagon. And really, he burst on the scene in February 1950 with holding up a piece of paper, says, "I have a list of 205 communists in the State Department." Changed the number to 57, then kept changing the number. But that was the beginning of what we call the McCarthy era, as far as that one particular person goes.
If my memory serves me correctly, that in the list that he actually held up with the names of hundreds was actually a dry cleaning bill.
I have heard that story.
Well, he certainly did take us to the cleaners. But so let's go back. Your story starts by recounting Vermont's congressman from 1934 to 1950 was a fellow named Charles Plumley of Northfield. And you say he was Vermont's very own McCarthy before McCarthy was. Who was he and what did he do?
Well, if you go to Northfield any time and you go onto the Norwich campus, you'll see the Plumley Armory, you'll see the Plumley Gallery. He had been president of Norwich in the late 20s. He had been a state legislator from Northfield, and ran for Congress in 1934 and served and kept serving. We have to remember that Vermont was pretty monolithic Republican in those days. So if there was going to be any serious challenge to Plumley, it was going to have to come within a Republican primary. And he didn't have a serious challenger until 1942. people who live in the Woodstock area are quite familiar with the name of Ogden. And this was Sam Ogden who chose to run against Plumlee and was what is termed red-baited, that Plumlee was saying he has communistic tendencies and he is in favor of labor unions. And so Plumlee was really an arch-conservative who saw the labor movement as being dominated by communists. And you might call him Vermont's own McCarthy, but he didn't quite have the demagogic skills that Joseph McCarthy did. And when I went back to 1946, which is where the first chapter is, and seeing the various newspaper editorials, such as from the Brattleboro Reformer, he was kind of a... both his admirers and detractors referred to him as Uncle Charlie, that he was a very comfortable figure. They knew his faults, they knew his strengths, and they knew that he loved to rail about communist influence. And when he actually got a challenger, a serious challenger in 1946, there were these editorials I read, they saying, well, Uncle Charlie, this may be it for you. So he was not a fearsome figure in Vermont politics.
Hmm. What brought him down?
Well, he didn't get brought down. He actually, he survived that challenge. My first chapter is about this challenge by a UVM professor named Andrew Newquist, and who was successfully red-baited by Plumlee. He made that a campaign issue. Newquist came close, but did not win. Plumlee served, he ran for one more cycle and then retired in 1950. But after he retired, he continued to get headlines by charging that communism was influencing Vermont's textbooks. He wanted to set up a textbook censorship commission, and those ideas were shot down by the Vermont legislature and the Vermont Teachers Association.
You have one of the things that's really fun in your book, Red Scare in the Green Mountains, is you have a lot of newspaper clippings that appear with each page, and one of them has, you know, Vermont governor pledges state purge of Reds in 1950, and you have a series of other headlines. Where did you find all these old newspaper clippings? Nowadays, of course, we're used to just looking on the internet and things come up in very sterile fashion, but you have actually, you know, faded edge newspaper clips.
Well, at the time that I started this research, all the state newspapers are on microfilm, and it was at the Vermont State Library, which until last year had been kind of part of the law library on State Street in Montpelier. A year and a half ago, it all got moved to the Middlesex, the state archives. So when I first started researching this, I knew there were very specific times, like I knew that Senator Flanders challenged McCarthy, and I knew that was in the spring of 1954. I knew that Professor Alex Novikov got fired from UVM in 1953 in June. So I went back and I took sort of the two papers of record, if you will, in Vermont, the Burlington Free Press and the Rutland Herald, and slowly but surely cranked those microfiche machines, and then occasionally something would send me towards some of the smaller papers, like the White River Valley Herald, which I was delighted to see actually had the actual newspapers in big binders in their office in Randolph, where you could actually sit at a table and turn the pages. rather get a stiff neck and sore eyes.
Well, I mean, even the image of what you're describing, you know, as a college student and in subsequent years, I spent a lot of time looking at microfiche and old newspapers to get that primary source material. But again, if anybody under probably the age of 40 at this point has never seen what you've seen, mm-hmm. the actual newspapers. So, and again, we're talking with Rick Winston. He's the author of a new book, Red Scare in the Green Mountains. What brought the town of Bethel and a fellow named Owen Lattimore played a particularly significant role in bringing the Red Scare to Vermont. So tell us a little bit about what happened in Bethel.
This is a tangled and fascinating tale, and it involves a supposedly famous person that I had never heard of before. He was famous in the earlier part of the century for being an Arctic explorer. His name is Vilhelmur Stefansson. He had not done any exploring for years and years. At the age of 60, he bought a summer place in Bethel and invited his good friend, who is a Far East expert, Owen Lattimore, up to summer with him in Vermont. Lattimore had been a very important person in the government. He taught at Johns Hopkins University. He was President Roosevelt's his personal emissary to Chiang Kai-shek in China when China was fighting in World War II. Lattimore became very disillusioned with Chiang Kai-shek as the war ended and was urging whoever would listen to him in the government to start negotiations with the Chinese communists. Because he saw in the future that they were probably going to be taking over the government. Lattimore bought land from Stefansson, an adjoining piece of land. His intention was to start a school of what he called Asiatic studies. He had several people in Mongolia who he was eager to help get out of Mongolia before the Chinese communists took over. But at the same time, McCarthy named Lattimore as the master spy in the State Department. To Lattimore's great surprise, because he didn't work in the State Department, and he knew he could prove these charges false, but because he was going to rack up some legal bills, he reluctantly had to sell the piece of land. His friend Stefansson put an ad in Saturday Review of Literature, and the one and only person who answered the ad turned out to be somebody who had run for governor on the communist ticket in Alabama in 1942. So that story kind of blew up, and that's when you'll see a headline in the book that McCarthy charges that land sale, money goes to communist coffers or something like that.
McCarthy alleges sale of Vermont property by Owen Lattimore to alleged Reds.
Yeah.
The property sold to married couple is in Bethel. His area, McCarthy says.
In those days, it took probably 3 hours to get from Bethel, where Lattimore lived, to Peacham, where Alger Hiss was also had his moment of notoriety in the late 40s.
He was accused of being a spy for the Soviet Union.
He was accused of being a spy. He was actually convicted not of being a spy, but of perjury. So he was in jail. His family still maintained their house in Peacham, but because it was in Vermont, McCarthy felt that he could say that Bethel was in his area.
You know, we're living in a moment of demagogues all around the world and in our own country. I'm intrigued, how does a guy like McCarthy, I mean, he's an obscure junior senator from Wisconsin, how does he get traction?
I think the ground was fertile for him. When you look at what happened in the previous 4 years that McCarthy made that speech, there was Churchill's Iron Curtain speech in 1946. There was the beginning of the Hollywood blacklist with greatly publicized hearings at the House and American Activities Committee with the various Hollywood writers and directors. There was the Alger Hiss case. Richard Nixon was cut of the same cloth. He saw the anti-communist bandwagon and he got on it and he helped move it along with his reckless claims to win a California Senate seat. So I think if you go back and kind of immerse yourself in the news stories of the time, McCarthy was... the funny thing is that McCarthy was looking for an issue, according to his biographers, all through the late 40s to give him a bigger profile. And for a while, it was going to be this building, the St. Lawrence Seaway.
But well, so he our country would have been a lot better off if he stuck to seaways instead of...
There was a huge streak of opportunism in McCarthy and a very gullible press. And
all right, well, let's pick it up there. We're going to take a break for some news headlines from the hopefully not gullible press. And we're talking with Rick Winston. He's the author of Red Scare in the Green Mountains. I'm David Goodman. We're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We'll be back right after this news.
The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman is underwritten in part by Community Capital of Vermont, Green Mountain Power, The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, and by Let's Grow Kids, as well as nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Our guest this hour is Rick Winston. He's the author of a new book, Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy Era, 1946 to 1960. Rick, just before the break, you referred to the role of a gullible press. Talk about the role of the press in contributing to the Red Scare and in perpetuating it.
Well, the press nationally contributed to it by repeating McCarthy's headline-grabbing charges without doing too much investigation. And that's where the role of the Vermont press was very different. And in the case of the Bethel incident that we talked about, McCarthy made these outrageous charges. And John Drysdale of the White River Herald saw how out of control this whole thing was getting. And he went to his friend, fellow publisher, Robert Mitchell, who is the editor and publisher of the Rutland Herald, and said, "We're a weekly. There's only so much we can do, but you're a daily, and you're a very powerful daily. Can you help kind of put out this fire?" So Mitchell then enlisted his friend, who was the editor of the Brattleboro Reformer, John Hooper. And the two of them hired an investigative journalist from New York to come up and dig, 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 dig. And the result was a six-part long investigative series on what this whole Bethel thing was about. And they managed that. There's a writer named William Gilman. These were long, long articles. It was on the front page every day for 6 days in a row in August of 1950, taking a different aspect of the story. And they just completely destroyed McCarthy's claim that this was a communist plot, that the communists were actually making any money from it, because Stephenson was actually taking a loss on the sale. Could easily be proved by going to the town clerk in Bethel, but not many people were interested in doing that.
Did the investigative series make a dent in McCarthy?
Well, you know, all I have to go by is the evidence of the papers, and that 2 weeks after the series ran, the story was off the front page, and that was it. I saw various letters to the editor saying, commending them for running the series, but the hysteria really died down. Unfortunately for Owen Lattimore, the case dragged on for 6 years. People were really out to get him. It was part of this relates to another chapter in the book too, that there was when the communists led by Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai took over the Chinese government in 1949, it sent shockwaves through the government, the U.S. government, that how could such a thing have happened? It must be somebody's fault. And it became known as Who Lost China? And now, years later, the lost is in quotation marks.
So a few other stories from your book, Red Scare in the Green Mountains. And again, if listeners have any memories or stories of their own from the Red Scare in Vermont, feel free to contribute them. Call us at 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. A UVM medical school professor by the name of Alex Novikov. What happened to him? What was his story?
Well, this was an interesting story because it was Vermont's only high-profile academic firing as a result of the Red Scare. Many other states, there was a purge of many academic institutions, anybody who had previously been a communist. In fact, in Novikov's alma mater alone, 30 people lost their jobs.
His alma mater being?
Brooklyn College.
Okay.
Yeah. So Novikov had been summoned to testify before the U.S. Senate Internal Security Committee investigating supposed communist subversion at New York City colleges, universities. And Novikov, at that point, had not been a member of the Communist Party for a few years. And his tack that he took with the committee was, I'll tell you about myself, but I'm not going to name anybody else. I'm not going to tell you anything involving any other person. And for that, he was held in contempt. This was not as straightforward a maneuver as it could be imagined, because it turns out that people like Harvey Mattuso, professional informers, were waiting. You know, and if Novikov would say, "Did you know this person?" If they asked him, "Did you know this person?" and he said, "No." And somebody like Mattuso would step forward and say, "Well, I was at a meeting, and they clearly knew each other."
And just to remind listeners, Mattuso, Harvey Mattuso, was the informant who brought down your father, a New York City
among many other people.
Teacher. We have a caller on the line. Chris is calling from Averill Lake. Chris, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Hey, how are you doing today? I'm a summer resident here, loving your program today. You guys might be amused to know that even though I'm not a resident of Vermont, I am a utility commissioner, a public utility commissioner in the state of Washington. And I just wanted to mention two things. And first off, the reason I called is I had a friend who attended Boston College and did her thesis on McCarthyism. And she stirred up so much of a hornet's nest amongst her faculty members that they failed to give her a good grade because they didn't feel that she had lived through it as they had and had been challenged, as many academics were during that era, if they had any leanings whatsoever that was suspect. They could lose their jobs almost immediately. And the old provisions of tenure did not protect you from scrutiny, especially from government sources or Senate investigations, etc. As far as my public utility experience, I will just say anybody who's running a municipal utility, a mutual, a co-op, which Vermont certainly has, and in my case, it's a public utility district, which are in three West Coast states, and the entire state of Nebraska is public utilities. We have always been red-baited as Red Scare tactics for many years, and the fight for public power is intrinsic to some of the wrappings around of the flag of the opponents who don't see the value of it and are scared of the consequences of people taking control of their own utilities.
Chris, have you personally been red-baited in this fashion, or any of your colleagues in Washington?
Well, I would led probably the nation's largest municipalization effort in recent history. It's a county of about 270,000, 275,000. Happens to be the capital of the state of Washington, which isn't noticed much out here, and didn't even get reported in the papers in my home state very well. But municipalizations, which is the name for going from a private to a public utility, happen frequently around the country. Boulder, San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, even in the state of Florida. Usually they're cities, not whole counties, as in my case. But usually, like Boulder is a good example, they're still fighting it out there, even though they won the vote. It's an effort that certain states allow in state law a lot easier than others. Many eastern states, which have been used to private utilities, do not make it easy to make yourself into a public utility. And this includes water, telecommunications, sewer, as well as electricity, which is the real fought-over issue, simply because you can make more money from electricity from less expenditure of capital.
Okay, well, Chris, thanks so much for sharing that story.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that there's a connection between the two.
Yes, thank you. And I noticed in my research that University of Washington took a very big hit during this time. It was one of the states where there was a tremendous right-wing movement to remove left-leaning
professors. Oh, yeah.
Professors.
People even got killed and assassinated during that time period or later into the 60s. And I'll just say that Washington's unique because we have the most amount of public utility customers in the whole country. Even though Nebraska is 100% public, it's a much smaller state. So we're about 50%, and we still have three private utilities in our state, and two of them are foreign-owned now.
Great.
Well, Rick Winston, I want to turn to the downfall of McCarthyism and the role that Vermont played in that. Vermont's senator at the time that McCarthy was unleashing this reign of terror was a guy named Ralph Flanders. Tell us about Flanders and what his relationship was like with McCarthy.
Ralph Flanders was a very conservative businessman, very successful businessman from Springfield, Vermont. Had a tool and die factory. And he was appointed to take over the Senate seat vacated when Warren Austin was nominated to be the ambassador to the United Nations. So Flanders came into the Senate, and even though George Aiken was perceived as much more liberal than Flanders, Flanders was the one who wound up taking on McCarthy. He was very offended by McCarthy's reckless attacks, his disregard for the facts, and being a staunch anti-communist himself, Flanders felt that McCarthy was A, hurting the anti-communist cause, and B, destroying the Republican Party. And at a certain point, Flanders felt that he had the tacit approval of Dwight D. Eisenhower, as the president at that time, that Eisenhower shared some of these concerns about the health of the Republican Party, and tacitly encouraged Flanders to go after McCarthy. So one of the chapters in the book is the whole story of how the Rutland Herald broke the story of Flanders' attempt to censure McCarthy in the Senate, and how they and other Vermont newspapers supported Flanders every step of the way.
So we're talking now 1954.
It's
4 years after McCarthy first made his red baiting speech.
And it was right at the beginnings of the so-called Army McCarthy hearings, which played a large part in changing the perception of McCarthy in the public mind. It was a time when people were just getting television sets. And they could kind of see this guy in action, and what a bully he was.
So my question related to that, there is this famous moment in the Army McCarthy hearings, and we should explain that McCarthy was trying to, you know, essentially rummage through every branch of government, particularly the State Department. And then, curiously, he takes aim at the United States Army to find the supposed Reds who are lurking in the Pentagon. And he runs up against this patrician attorney from Boston by the name of Joseph Welch, who at one point responds, and this is on TV, "Senator McCarthy, have you no decency?" And this is often attributed as the turning point.
Many people feel that it was. What McCarthy did to elicit that reaction was that Welch himself was being red-baited by McCarthy, saying, "I know that on your staff there is a young lawyer named Fred Fisher, and Fred Fisher was a member of the National Lawyers Guild, and I know that the National Lawyers Guild is a branch of the Communist Party." That much is debatable. So Welch said, "As a matter of fact, before we came down to Washington, I took my whole staff and I said, if there's anything in your past, McCarthy's going to jump on it. So if you are afraid that might happen, I will ask you not to come with me." And Fred Fisher stayed behind. So he really hit Welch where it hurt. So that's when I think the other statement that Welch made was, "Until this moment, I had not gauged your cruelty or recklessness."
So this is my question, Rick. I mean, McCarthy is hauling before him many eloquent, powerful, you know, leaders in the arts. Pete Seeger testified, others testified. There was no shortage of eloquent, you know, retorts to Joe McCarthy. Why did this one, you know, Welch's reply to, why did that one suddenly put the wheels spinning in reverse?
You have to remember that there were other people running other committees. McCarthy had no end of enablers in the Congress and Senate. There was other congressional committees that called Arthur Miller, Pete Seeger, et cetera. This was televised, and McCarthy had, through his own miscalculation, taken on one of the most powerful institutions in the country, the Army. And there were people who really had it in for him. So I think people relished, institutions, high place people who were not particularly courageous in coming forward and attacking McCarthy were eager to see him get his comeuppance. And if it was on live TV, so much the better. And that's what did it. It should be mentioned that a year before, Edward R. Murrow had been very eloquent in attacking McCarthy. So the groundwork had been laid.
Fast forward to 2018. We have another demagogue in office, Donald Trump, who misses, I don't think an hour goes by now. We used to measure these things in weeks and days. Now we measure them in hours and minutes, where he isn't baiting somebody in some fashion. What are the parallels that you see from the McCarthy era to the era we're living in right now? And in particular, there's that phrase, it can't happen here. Can it?
Well, there's one very direct line from then to now, and it's if you look at these hearings, the Army McCarthy hearings, and there's a lot of footage, you can see a lot of it on YouTube. Sitting right next to McCarthy is a young aide named Roy Cohn, who actually helped bring on the whole controversy of the Army McCarthy hearings, but that's another story. 25-year-old Roy Cohn was McCarthy's protege. 50-year-old Roy Cohn was Donald Trump's protege. When Trump was just a Queens developer looking to get to make his name in the world of Manhattan high life, people suggested go kneel and kiss Roy Cohn's ring. And that's what he did. And if you could imagine wanting Roy Cohn for a mentor or Donald Trump for a protege. But I think Trump learned from Cohn, lie big, lie often, attack, insult, slime, and never apologize. And what's really ironic to me is that if you look in the dictionary, under McCarthyism, it will say something about reckless charges and guilt by association. It's not a neutral definition. I mean, as somebody has pointed out, there are no statues to Joseph McCarthy or avenues named after him. So Donald Trump feels that he can use the words witch hunt, and everybody will know what that means, that is a very discredited term to be doing. However, he is using McCarthy's tactics, really smearing his opponents, reprehensible nicknames for the people that he doesn't like, and feeling like he can get away with anything in the press as long as he dominates the news cycle. So we're waiting for our Joseph Welch's and our Ralph Landers at the... I heard that today, actually 200 major and some smaller newspapers are all running the same editorial, that they all agreed that they were going to run a coordinated statement decrying this use of the term enemy of the people and fake news and kind of standing up for their rights as journalists. So I think that's something that we got to keep an eye on, how strong our institutions are going to be.
But part of what led to McCarthy's downfall is a member of his own party, Ralph Landers, beginning the process of the Senate censuring him, which takes some time to actually happen. I don't recall the timeline, but...
It went on for about 6 months.
Yes. Do we have that figure in American politics today? And you know, you can't even say of Ralph Landers' stature, because he didn't really have much stature.
That's true. And he was himself a very unlikely person to be taking on McCarthy, coming from his background. I don't know. You know, the only people in the Republican Party who are opposed to Trump have decided not to run again. So what I'm thinking is that maybe, like McCarthy, Trump's time in the spotlight will be 4 years. But it's clear that it's not going to be over when he's gone. What he has unleashed in American political life is the genie is out of the bottle.
Okay, well, Rick Winston, I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation, and also to let listeners know that you and I will have a conversation about your book, The Red Scare in the Green Mountains, on, I think it's October 11th.
Thursday, October 11th, right down the street.
Bridgeside Books. So thanks again for joining us. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We've been talking with Rick Winston. He's the author of Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy Era, 1946 to 1960, which you can get at your local independent bookstore and other places. I'm David Goodman. Thanks for listening. Tune in next Wednesday at 1 for another Vermont Conversation, and anytime at vermontconversation.com.
The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable child care in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. By Community Capital of Vermont, providing equal access to financing for Vermonters with excellent ideas and the courage and resourcefulness to start and grow small businesses. Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers to create a home, business, and community-based energy system that's clean, reliable, and cost-effective. The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, committed to a healthy and clean environment, strong communities, and craft beer, alchemistbeer.com. And by UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine, as well as nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more from www.vbsr.org.